Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. From the P.E. Monroe Auditorium at Lenoir Ryan University in Hickory, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Armistead Maupin is famous for his fiction, particularly his nine-book series of Tales of the City novels, which told the story of life in San Francisco in the 1970s, specifically that of the gay community there. In the process, he plowed new ground, both in fiction and in life, because those stories were first published in the newspaper, introducing straight San Franciscans to their gay neighbors and changing more than a few minds in the process. But Maupin's own life story is even more interesting. He grew up in North Carolina in a conservative family, eventually working for Jesse Helms, but shed that skin when he moved to the city by the bay. His collective works and his recently published memoir, Logical Family, caught the attention of the folks who run the Lenoir Ryan Visiting Writers Series, and that is why Armistead Maupin has come home, at least momentarily, to join us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
So you were born in Washington, D.C., but raised in
Raleigh.
In Raleigh by a dyed-in-the-wool Southern supporter of the Confederacy, your father, and the daughter of a suffragette, an English suffragette, your mother. And you say in Logical Family, this book, your memoir, you wrote it because you wanted credit for overcoming the influences of your childhood. At what point did you begin to chafe at this very conservative upbringing?
When I got to San Francisco and wasn't getting laid by dropping Jesse Helms' name. I'd pick up guys out on Polk Street, which was the gay district at the time, and take them back to my little pent shack, as I called it. And they would see this picture of me shaking hands with Nixon and recoil in horror. That's the glib answer. The honest answer is that I met people that were that I admired and respected, and they didn't hold to my kind of thinking, and I began to re-examine everything. Mm. I was sort of there, anyway. I mean, I was a little secret queer in the sense that I was, my heart was there already.
And evidently it had been there from a very young age, because you say at six, and maybe I'm misinterpreting this, but tell me if I am, you felt, quote, this shapeless longing, an oddly grown-up ennui born of alienation and silence. Some children experience this feeling early on, long before we learn its name and finally let our headstrong hearts lead the way to true north. We grow up as another species entirely, lone gazelles, lost amid the buffalo herd of our closest kin. Is that because you knew you weren't them?
Yeah.
And not just conservative
that's
them.
That's the crux of it.
But heterosexual them.
Queer. You know it at an early age. You feel it. And you often suffer from it. I had a great English grandmother, that suffragette, who told me that I was the reincarnation of her cousin Curtis, her bachelor cousin Curtis, her extremely artistic bachelor cousin Curtis. So she was on to me. She was on to me early on.
So was your mother, wasn't she?
Yes, she was, I think.
Mothers always know.
They know, and their instincts, sadly, is to always to anticipate protecting you. And in my mother's case, that she thought my world was going to hell when I was coming out and speaking about Anita Bryant. She said, "Darling, I just don't want it to hurt your career." And I said, "You don't understand, Mommy. It is my career."
So when could you first identify? When could you first put a label on what this alienation was all about?
It was tough. I mean, it's hard to say when that was. I suppose I knew something was amiss when I started, but I became a huge fan of Tallulah Bankhead on the radio.
Anybody remember Tallulah Bankhead?
Somebody must be old enough. It was called The Big Show. And she came on, it was a variety show, really. And at the end of every show, she sang, "May the good Lord bless and keep you," et cetera. And,
that's a good impression.
Thank you. It's required of a gay man. You have to have at least a passable one. I'm better at my Tallulah than I am at my Betty Davis, but... You know when you're starting to be attracted to other boys or girls, you know. Hmm. And it has to be a secret if you're raised in a repressive household. That's why I'm completely committed to the notion of getting to young people and telling them that their life doesn't have to live in terror. So much of the South, that still happens because of, may I say it, the churches. I'm here with the generosity of a Lutheran organization, but some churches preach such vile stuff from the pulpit that there must be many, many terrified children there.
Yeah. Of course, things are, I would hope, different than they were back when you were growing up. We're talking about the 40s, 50s, 60s in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Your father you describe as a staunch Confederate. And from what I read about him in the book, he's angry most of the time. He was successful, wasn't he? He was a lawyer, right?
Yeah. That.
What was he angry about?
Well, that's kind of the mystery of the story for a while. I guess I can tell you. But his father killed himself when he was 16 years old. And my father became the man of the family, got summoned from Chapel Hill. He had to deal with that. And we never talked about it. I didn't know until I was 15, and a friend of mine told me that he'd defended my father in conversation. So he lived with that, and I like to think that's where the anger came from. I mean, he was also a creature of the times. You know, that's what, his racism was part of that, I think. But he was particularly vocal on that subject.
Is that why he didn't think he should be gentle with gentle boys such as yourself? He thought.
Yeah, my mother was mollycoddling me. That was the term they used then. Thank God for the mollycoddling, I'll tell you. They took me to the Raleigh Little Theater. My mother did, because she was in plays there sometimes. So I had that experience. I remember my father saying, getting really angry when he had to cook his own meal. And he said, "Your mother's down at the theater with the fairies." So I knew what he felt about that very early on.
So how was your child? How would you describe your childhood then? I mean, you have a mother who mollycoddled you. You had a father who was really strict and didn't want to mold you into the man he thought you could be. So what was your childhood like?
Well, my father liked to garden. And we bonded through that. He would get me down to help him build dams in the creek and that sort of thing. So he had a side to him that was artistic, but he didn't like you to see it. I don't know. I have happy memories of coming up to the mountains when I was a kid. I went to a camp called Camp Hemlock. Camp Hemlock. Sure, like Camp Strychnine or something. I was thinking about this yesterday. It was all coming rushing back when I started thinking about the Western North Carolina. There was a really pretty young woman who had been Miss North Carolina, I think, who taught riding, and she was sweet to me. I was hot for the camp counselor.
When you read this book, at least for the first part of your life, it seems that you were doing everything that you possibly could do to get your father's approval.
Yeah.
Why? Why was that so important to you? Is it just a father-son kind of thing?
Yeah,
is that all it is?
Yeah, you want to please your dad.
I mean, a lot of boys might have rebelled against that. You never rebelled.
No, I didn't for a long time. But when I did, Lollapalooza.
That's right. You can only keep it in so long.
You can only keep it in so long.
I mean, your father was a racist. Your mother was kind of a racist, at least by today's standards, she was. You used the N-word as a little boy until your mother told you to stop using that. And it seems your daddy didn't stop. So how did that come together in your mind? Daddy can say this, but I can't.
Well, I used that word because my friend, who was the maid's daughter, had stolen my steam shovel at the beach. So I pulled out the big guns. And my mother overheard it and said, do not use that word.
Right.
You hurt her feelings. And I said, but, you know, Daddy uses it all the time. He's your father. That's different. Well, it was different having him as a father, but... I don't want to make it all about that because I have really happy memories of my childhood.
Good.
I wasn't mistreated.
And your mom was an actress, but she also you talk about her sitting in another room in the house and you could hear her typing. And she also did a radio show, didn't she?
She did. She had a advice for teenagers radio show with a panel of high school students. Oh, I shudder to think what she told them. It's called Under 21. And she was a writer, now that I think about it. She was a writer. She typed on this funny old thing that looked swung up out of the desk like a Victorian magic act. and she wrote to her mother. She wrote to all of us when we were away. I got letters at camp. I got letters that were 6 pages long at camp. Which I welcomed because I hated camp. She was a very creative person.
Yeah. Is that where the writing gene comes from, you think? Your mom?
So. I think it does, actually. My grandmother, her mother, the English woman who was a suffragist, let things in that radicalized me without my even feeling it. When I was 14 years old, I was going to a garden party at Mount Vernon, the one in Raleigh, which is slightly smaller than the one in Virginia, was somebody's pretentious house. And there was a woman ahead of us that was all pink and perfumed and spike-heeled, and she looked like, I describe her in the book as looking like a tipsy flamingo. My grandmother looked at her and then looked at me and had this sly little smirk on her face and said, any woman who is all woman or any man who is all man is a complete monster unfit for human company. Well, that was pretty radical to hear that.
Yeah.
In Raleigh in 1958. So I had these influences that were there.
So when we come back from the break, I want to talk about conservatism, how conservative you were, and the fact that you worked for Jesse Helms. That ought to be interesting. And the conversion from conservatism to where you are today. Armistead Maupin is our guest. Logical Family, a Memoir, is his book. Of course, he's the author of the Tales of the City series. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're at P.E. Monroe Auditorium at Lenore Ryan University in Hickory with Armistead Maupin. Armistead Maupin. I always want to give you a French pronunciation.
Everybody does. It's all right. It's okay. A French name.
It is. I know it is.
I answer to it in Paris, but...
Well, welcome to Paris.
Yeah. The Paris of the...
Of the Western Piedmont. So you went to Chapel Hill University North Carolina Chapel Hill. What was that like for a conservative?
I was the campus conservative.
Okay.
I got into into honorary organizations because of that. It's especially ironic. I was 4 or 5 years ago. I was given an honorary doctorate at Chapel Hill, and they cited all my LGBT work,
right,
and the writing itself. And so when I would stand there and say, this is a pretty nice thing to do for somebody that worked for Jesse Helms, and they would suck the air out of the room. And I'd have to say, relax, he's dead.
Let's talk about Jesse Helms. How did that, I know that you...
Yeah, I should say how I worked for
him. Yeah.
I got a job at WRAL-TV. He was the executive vice president of, and I wanted to be a writer. And so Jesse gave me my first writing job. And at one point, he brought me into his office and said, because I was conservative, that he thought I was the hope of the future. Which is the only thing he's ever been right about. You told me I was allowed one of those words.
Yes.
I think I'll use it there. And
so Jesse Helms brought you in, and I know that you also became a reporter at WRAL-TV.
I did.
And at one point, you you were doing mundane stories because you were really young. You were just fresh out of college.
Yeah.
You were doing all the
Kiwanis Club.
Yeah, all that
flower
stuff.
Show.
But one day there was you were sent out to cover a Klan meeting or a Klan rally.
Klan rally, yeah.
A Klan rally, and you got a chance to get an interview with the Grand Wizard of the KKK.
I think he was the Imperial Wizard.
Okay, excuse me. So tell people what you chose to ask the Imperial Wizard about.
Well, I had a reporter's eye, so Dean Rusk's daughter had been just...
Secretary of State, Dean Rusk.
Secretary of State, mm-hmm. Dean Rusk. His daughter had been, her wedding picture had been on the cover of Time magazine because she had just married an African-American man. And it was, in fact, I think the first interracial marriage in, I got to get that right, but it was history-making,
yeah,
in terms of that. And so I thought, I'll ask him what he thinks of that. Maybe that'll be some lively answer. And he said, well, I don't think anybody needs to be surprised. He's a liberal, and he probably raised his daughter to be a liberal. And besides, what else would you expect from a man who's a practicing homosexual? So I went back to Jesse and... very excited. I had this scoop, the grand, whatever he is, the Imperial. I'm sorry, that's two, isn't it? Yeah. I told him that, I had this scoop that this charge had been levied, and Jesse went absolutely white, whiter than he normally is. And, said that was the worst thing you could say about anybody, that we couldn't run it, the station could be sued for libel. That's the worst thing you can say about anyone. And so that's the first time I heard him hold forth on that subject.
Mm.
And it sort of foretold what was coming up, because I had a property, Tales of the City, that ended up being condemned by Jesse Helms and... caused bomb threats in Chattanooga and all sorts of things when the American Family Association came out against it.
Right. But you said, we can't be sued for libel because we're not going to say it. The Imperial Wizard's going to say it.
Yeah, that was my reasoning.
Yeah.
We've got him on tape. He says it. I don't know what Jesse's hang-up was on that subject. I got a good idea.
You worked with and for Jesse Helms. You were very conservative. You were in the Navy. it was in the Navy, wasn't it, that you began to explore yourself?
What did I do?
Explore your... I'm trying to be really gentle here. You began to explore your sexuality.
I was in the Navy when I had my first sex with a man.
Okay.
It was not with another sailor, but with someone I picked up on the battery in Charleston.
Okay.
If you're familiar with that lovely park. I thought my father would at least appreciate it because it was the spot where the first shots of the Civil War were fired. The memoir says, I wish I could be colorful about this for posterity, but it was pretty awful. Yeah. And I remember thinking at the time, because it was a big hit that summer, that all I needed was for Peggy Lee to be standing in the corner of the room singing, Is That All There Is?
So you're in trouble.
Is that what you meant by exploring myself?
Exactly. That's what I meant. And you volunteered to go into the Navy during the Vietnam War. Is that right?
Yeah.
Also to please your father?
I volunteered for the Navy, and it was the Vietnam War, so I could get drafted. So right. The Navy seemed like a good idea, the officer candidate school. But I volunteered when my captain down in Charleston got transferred to Saigon to be the chief of staff. I asked him if I could go with him. And I really thought I'd hit the jackpot with the old man then, and I did. He loved it. He had a war map in the house with pins in it. It was where I was moving. Mostly I was taking VIPs on tours of the war.
Yeah.
I wanted that. And I wanted it, I think, also from a standpoint, it's strictly a political standpoint. I love the adventure of it and seeing a fresh new place. My mother said I had a Lawrence of Arabia complex, which is a whole lot closer to the truth than she knew.
Look it up.
Or see the movie.
Yes, or see the movie. When you got out of the Navy, you went to Charleston and you worked, I guess, for the Charleston Post and Courier
It was the News and Courier.
News and Courier. As a newspaper, is that what you wanted to be, a newspaper reporter, or you just wanted an opportunity to write? Why in the newspaper?
I was not really taking to writing news. I wanted to make up, and so I did, and here I am. It really was more in my instinct to create something.
Right.
And I left the AP in San Francisco for precisely the reason that I felt like I was...
When you went to San Francisco, you went for the AP. They first offered you a job in Buffalo, and you kind of hemmed and hawed and didn't get back to them until they finally called you and said, well, would San Francisco be better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
An old lady in Charleston... who was the artist whose house I lived in, said to me, honey, from what I hear told, Buffalo is no place you want to shuffle off to.
And halfway across the country, driving to San Francisco to work for the AP, Associated Press, you get your dinner with a friend. And the friend's mother, the phone rings, she gets up, she answers the phone. It's the White House.
Yep. Haldeman, I believe. Bob Haldeman of the Dirty Tricks Department. Said, where's Tom? Where's your son? The president wants to see him in the Oval Office on Tuesday. And by the way, do you happen to know where Armistead Maupin is? And so we were in this totally Norman Rockwell setting of at dinner and the whole thing. And we had formed a group that had gone back to Vietnam to build houses for disabled Vietnamese veterans. It sounds altruistic. It was actually a put-up stunt on the part of the Dirty Tricks Department to draw attention away from the Vietnam veterans against the war, because our angle was, we are veterans and we're trying to do something good, and oh, blah, blah, blah. And they knew, Nixon knew that John Kerry was going to be demonstrating on the lawn for the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, and we were invited on that specific day to be there at the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm.
It's not hard to imagine this happening this very day about something where they need to draw the attention away from something. So we went in and met the president. And I was immediately felt bad for him because he was so socially ill at ease. And particularly with young men, he just didn't know what to do and how to be, and he was sweating up a storm. And finally he said, "You know, those Vietnamese women are not traditionally attractive. But when they wear those little aliyahs, their little dresses look like butterflies." And I was thoroughly creeped out. And I told that story to Douglas Brinkley, the historian, who was doing a book on John Kerry at the time. And he called me back and said, "Well, I checked the tapes." And I thought, the tapes? I was on the tapes? My first thought was one of panic as a writer, and sometimes fabulous, that I had told him a story that didn't pan out. You know, that he actually had what was actually said in the room.
Right.
And he said it was much funnier than I even than I even knew.
So when you got to California, what was that like? You're a guy from Raleigh, I know you'd been to the Vietnam and you'd seen things and you were more worldly than you were when you were at Chapel Hill or at WRAL. But this San Francisco had to be the late mid to late 70s? Is that when it was? When you
no,
got there?
No, 72.
72. Well, even then, it's 4 years after the Summer of Love, which went in both gay and straight directions. So what was that like for you? I mean, this is like a whole new world.
It was. I was enchanted. I felt young again. I wasn't old. I was 27, but I felt young again. I felt like I'd reclaimed something. We were all, you know, it was what they'd always promised to boys, standing on the corner watching all the girls go by, except it was boys.
Yeah.
And we were having that adolescence and the exhilaration of finding your own kind was amazing. Just to marvel at, we can be like this, can we? And, you know.
Is it like taking a straitjacket off?
Yeah, it was completely like that. Yeah.
You didn't stay long at the AP. You went to the San Francisco Chronicle, is that right?
Eventually. I quit the AP and then bounced around to a whole bunch of little jobs, freelancing, and I worked at the opera for a while. I didn't land in the honeypot of Tales of the City until 1976.
Yeah, when you went to work for the Chronicle, were you there to be a reporter or a columnist? What?
They hired me on a reporter's salary. But the agreement was that I would write this fictional serial.
They wanted that? Was that their idea?
Oh, that
you talked them into it.
I had done it in the Pacific Sun, a mm-hmm. Marin County paper, on a weekly basis. And I said, sure, I can do it 5 days a week. 800 words a day, 5 days a week. Had no idea where it was going. But I did it.
For people who don't write an 800-word column, what does that look like on a piece of paper when you type it out?
Oh, it's going to be about four pages.
Three pages, 5 days a week? Made up?
Made up.
So
sometimes from whatever happened to me the night before.
So I know it starts fairly innocuous. Did you know who all the characters were going to be when you introduced them, or did they just pop into your head on a Wednesday afternoon for your Friday column?
Yeah, often I had to invent somebody fast, and that's what happened. I had, you know, But I sort of lucked out. I mean, I think I was going with my subconscious a lot. And it's a weird way to write, but things would come up that panned out later. I talked to Neil Gaiman about this, the great sci-fi writer who did Sandman, the Sandman mm-hmm. graphic novel, and he had the same feeling, that exhilaration of you're just one step ahead of them, but just barely. And it was thrilling.
Did they know, they bought your idea of a fictionalized serial. Did the editors of that paper know that it was going to be groundbreaking, that you were going to introduce gay characters and ultimately a transgendered character into the story? Did they know that ahead of time, or
no,
you were going to write stories about San Francisco?
I wouldn't tell them that, no. I knew what I was going to do, and I knew what I had to do to keep it. And in fact, when I made the mistake of telling them that Anna Madrigal, the landlady, was transgender, or transsexual, as we said then, they said, well, you can't do that for at least a year. We'll lose readership. They felt the readers would be horrified. What they said specifically was, which is very funny if you know San Francisco, it will alienate the people in the sunset. Those are little row houses, many with Chinese families. I don't know what they thought was going to happen, but that was I always thought the phrase, the people in the sunset, sounded like a zombie movie or something. But
a blessing in disguise, actually, right?
It was, because I was forced to behave myself and not tell her secret right away. And I built her as a lovable character.
Yeah.
And it looked like I was deliberately withholding the mystery, which I was. So by the time they found out, they were just thoroughly on her side.
We're going to take a break and come back with more tales of Armistead Maupin and his logical family and his tales of the city as Charlotte Talk continues from Lenore Ryan University. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Armistead Maupin is with us. We're on the stage at the P.E. Monroe Auditorium at Lenore Ryan University for the Visiting Writers series, and we're talking about his memoir, Logical Family, and also about what made him famous and put him on the map across the country, Tales of the City, the 9-volume book, started as a column for the San Francisco Chronicle, became a television show, and is going to become a new television show, which we'll talk about that. You told the Washington Post that you see writing as a way of telling a story of something painful and then giving it harmony and purpose, of making sense out of chaos. Was that one of the functions of Tales of the City, to explain the LGBT world to straight people and also to help LGBT people in San Francisco at the time who were just beginning to feel the freedom to be able to be publicly who they were, to explain their world to them, to let them see it in print?
Well, I can't say it was that calculated, but yeah. I mean, I knew I was getting the response from people. People were loving it and telling me that, and not just queer people either, you know. A lot of the single women in the town who couldn't figure out why all these attractive men weren't available liked having their story told, too. It's easy to say that I was consciously leading a literary revolution. I knew that I was, because every day I had to fight with the editors on something. But it was mostly fun. It was just fun. I was having a ball.
It's really hard to remember, particularly for young people. It'd be impossible for them to even know what it was like back then. But you were pulling the curtain back on a world most people didn't know. And if they thought they knew it, many of them were disgusted by the thought of it. And you laid the groundwork for what has come since. You were before Will and Grace. You were before Glee. You were before Queer as Folk. You were before Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. You set all that up.
Well, thank you. Sadly, I don't get royalties for any of those things. But I am proud of having done that.
How long did it take for the column to catch on when you knew, man, this is a hit? How long did that take?
Someone in the people department, which is where I worked, which is mostly women, it had been called the women's department, but this was the 70s, and so that they felt that that was in keeping with the new tide of feminism, that women were people too, radical thought. This woman I knew there said, let me show you something, but you've got to promise me you won't tell anybody. She took me into a janitor's closet and showed me three industrial-sized garbage cans full of letters. Tales of the City had stopped for a brief period, a two-week period, and it seemed to be over, and they were all people saying, I'm not going to subscribe to the Chronicle anymore if you don't keep Tales of the City in it. They didn't want me to see it because I would do what I did and ask for more money. But, I knew. And I could tell it. I could feel it in the city. People arrived at my little house on the roof on scavenger hunts, looking for something from me or, you know, it's crazy. Bars in the town named drinks after Anna Madrigal. And
right. because of the times, this is before the internet, your parents in Raleigh subscribed to the San Francisco Chronicle. Your life is unfolding in Tales of the City.
Yeah.
Do they know about you at this point?
My father said to my mother, how does an Eagle Scout know these things? That's a clue to my father, too. He had a sense of humor. I think they were just hoping that I wasn't revealing myself. Michael Tolliver was a Southerner. He was from Florida. But he wasn't me. His parents were Florida orange growers. That came in remarkably handy when Anita Bryant.
Oh, that wasn't up. That wasn't planned out?
No. No.
Oh, I just thought that was planned out.
No, it was a blessing.
But Michael was you, wasn't he?
Yeah, more or less.
More or less.
He was hotter than I was, sadly.
Michael,
I would never have entered the Jockey Shorts dance contest.
your parents were reading your Tales of the City, and there is a moment in the series of articles, and it's in the books, it's in the Tales of the City book, where Michael writes a letter to his mother.
Yeah.
This letter you've also included in your memoir, and the letter has taken on a life of its own. Talk about that.
Sure has. It's been set to music a number of times and is often performed by gay choruses around the country. My friend Ian McKellen has made it a part of his one-man show for years. He reads it. Russell Tovey, the great, well, I don't guess you can call him great yet, the young, hot English actor. Is very talented. It read it with the BBC Symphony last year. The irony is that it took less time to write than anything I've ever written because I'd been practicing for it for 15 years. I wanted to have exactly the right words on paper to describe how I felt about being gay. And I wanted my parents to see it. My mother was dying of cancer. At the time that this was published, and I wanted more than anything for her to see that I was happy and that everything was going well, and there was just total silence from Raleigh. My father wrote me a little short letter on his legal pad that said, basically telling me if I didn't shut up about this stuff, it was going to kill my mother even faster.
Yeah.
And I know he was suffering. He was in pain himself. He couldn't talk about it right up to the day she died. She was always bigger you know, in that regard than him. She knew how to be a parent more than he ever could. In fact, when she, on the day she died, really on the day, I was in her hospital room and in Durham, I guess, and she told me she wanted me to write a sweet book, by which she meant something like The Snow Goose, she said. I thought I'd written a sweet book about a nice transgender woman who had an affair with a man before he died, and it was sweet to me, but I knew what she meant. And then she said, and I want you to come back early in the morning because I've got an orderly I want you to meet.
Would you
sure.
Would you share that letter?
I would like to. It's, thank you.
It's right there. This is the letter to Mama written in 1977 as it appeared in Tales of the City.
Dear Mama, I'm sorry it's taken me so long to write. Every time I try to write to you and Papa, I realize I'm not saying the things that are in my heart. That would be okay if I loved you any less than I do, but you are still my parents, and I am still your child. I have friends who think I'm foolish to write this letter. I hope they're wrong. I hope their doubts are based on parents who loved and trusted them less than mine do. I hope especially that you'll see this as an act of love on my part, a sign of my continuing need to share my life with you. I wouldn't have written, I guess, if you hadn't told me about your involvement in the Save Our Children campaign. That, more than anything, made it clear to me that my responsibility was to tell you the truth, that your own child is homosexual, and that I never needed saving from anything except the cruel and ignorant piety of people like Anita Bryant. I'm sorry, Mama. Not for what I am, but for how you must feel at this moment. I know what that feeling is, for I felt it most of my life. Revulsion, shame, disbelief, rejection through fear of something I knew, even as a child, was as basic to my nature as the color of my eyes. No, Mama, I wasn't recruited. No seasoned homosexual ever served as my mentor. But you know what? I wish someone had. I wish someone older than me and wiser than the people in Orlando had taken me aside and said, "You're all right, kid. You can grow up to be a doctor or a teacher just like anyone else. You're not crazy or sick or evil. You can succeed and be happy and find peace with friends, all kinds of friends who don't give a damn who you go to bed with. Most of all, though, you can love and be loved without having to hate yourself for it." But no one ever said that to me, Mama. I had to find it out on my own with the help of the city that has become my home. I know this may be hard for you to believe, but San Francisco is full of men and women, both straight and gay, who don't consider sexuality in measuring the worth of another human being. These aren't radicals or weirdos, Mama. They are shop clerks and bankers and little old ladies and people who nod and smile at you when you meet them on the bus. Their attitude is neither patronizing nor pitying, and their message is so simple. Yes, you are a person. Yes, I like you. Yes, it's all right for you to like me too. I know what you must be thinking now. You're asking yourself, what did we do wrong? How did we let this happen? Which one of us made him that way? I can't answer that, Mama. In the long run, I guess I really don't care. All I know is this: if you and Papa are responsible for the way I am, then I thank you with all my heart, for it's the light and the joy of my life. I know I can't tell you what it is to be gay, but I can tell you what it's not. It's not hiding behind words, Mama, like family and decency and Christianity. It's not fearing your friends, fearing your body or the pleasure that God made for it. It's not judging your neighbor except when he's crass or unkind. Being gay has taught me tolerance, compassion, and humility. It has shown me the limitless possibilities of living. It has given me people whose passion and kindness and sensitivity have provided a constant source of strength. It has brought me into the family of man, Mama, and I like it here. I like it. There's not much else I can say except I'm the same Michael you've always known. You just know me better now. I've never consciously done anything to hurt you. I never will. Please don't feel you have to answer this right away. It's enough for me to know that I no longer have to lie to the people who taught me to value the truth. Mary Ann sends her love. Everything is fine at 28 Barbary Lane. Your loving son, Michael.
As you were reading that, I thought, what a gift to your mother.
I hope so.
Yeah. Tales of the City was a groundbreaking series of columns, a groundbreaking series of books, a groundbreaking television series, although we only saw, I think, one season of it in America on PBS. The censors got to the second season, I think. But Netflix is going to do this. It's the same characters, what, 40 years later?
Well, as Laura Linney says, don't do the math.
So it'll be Laura, and it will be Olympia Dukakis and others.
Paul Gross, who played Brian, is back. Barbara Garrick, who played Dee Dee.
Wow.
And then we have this new slew of young'uns. The brilliant Ellen Page, the brilliant and political Ellen Page. Did anybody hear her on Colbert the other night? Oh, my God. She's my dream come true. She's my hero, you know? A young person who can really speak the truth and speak it directly.
So what will this series be about? I mean, the ground has been broken. The doors have flung open. The flood has come out. What else is there to talk about?
Oh, we have some things. I mean, the world's quite different now. We're talking about non-binary people and everything else. I don't want to give anything away. But it does still address those issues of the human heart. It all ends up with people trying to find love.
You said that you, when you look back, you don't much like the Armistead Maupin of your youth. What do you think that young man would think of this man sitting here tonight?
You and your fancy questions. I'd like to think he'd be proud of me. Well, no, I don't care what that guy thinks. Because he was stupid. I mean, he was... I've tried to be forgiving of myself, my young self. That's what the answer to that is. I think that's what I've learned, that I should forgive him for not knowing the way out right away.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there.
Yeah.
Armistead Maupin, thank you for your books. I've read them all. They're wonderful. They're incredibly entertaining, including Logical Family, the memoir that you've just written. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.